So the night closed, and at breakfast next morning I heard that Edward had started for Wickerley soon after daybreak. His absence made, for me at least, a sad blank in our circle. For one other also, I think. For Miss Tremaine's fair, proud face was very pale, though she exerted herself to be agreeable to everyone. The days passed slowly for me. The house, full as it was of pleasant people, seemed to me to have become dull and dreary now that Edward was gone. Light-hearted young men still made the billiard room resonate with their laughter. Merry girls flirted as gaily as ever, yet for me all was changed. I found myself continually brooding over the housekeeper's words which boded death and sorrow to the house of Crichton. My cousins, Sophie and Agnes, were full of excitement about the New Year's ball, which was to be a very grand affair. Every one of importance within 50 miles was to be present. Every nook and corner of the abbey would be filled. The organization of this affair was no small business, and my cousin Fanny's time was fully occupied. As for the master of the abbey, he spent so much of his time in the library, where, under the pretext of business with his bailiff, he read Greek, that it was not easy for anyone to discover what he did feel. Once only I heard him speak of his son in a tone that betrayed an intense eagerness for his return. New Year's morning came at last with an almost spring-like sunshine lighting up the leafless landscape. The great dining room was noisy with congratulations and good wishes as we assembled for breakfast on this first morning of a new year. But Edward had not yet returned. Some touch of sympathy drew me to the side of Julia Tremaine on this particular morning. I had seen that her cheek grew paler every day. Today her eyes had the dull, heavy look that betokens a sleepless night. Yes, the proud, relentless nature suffered bitterly. "He must be home today," I said to her in a low voice. "Who must?" she answered. "My cousin Edward. You know he promised to be back in time for the ball." "I know nothing of Mr. Crichton's intended movements," she said in her haughtiest tone. "But, of course, it is only natural that he should be here tonight. He would scarcely care to insult half the county by his absence, however little he may value those now staying in his father's house." "But you know that there is one here whom he does value better than anyone else in the world, Miss Tremaine," I answered. "I know nothing of the kind. But why do you speak so solemnly about his return? He will come, of course. There's no reason he should not come." She looked at me with a sharp, inquiring glance that touched me somehow. It was so unlike herself. It revealed to me so keen an anxiety. "No, there is no reasonable cause for anything like uneasiness," I said. "But you remember what I told you the other night. It will be an unspeakable relief to me when I see my cousin safe at home." "I am sorry that you should indulge in such weakness, Miss Crichton." That was all she said. But when I saw her in the drawing-room after breakfast, she had established herself in a window that commanded a view of the long, winding drive leading to the front of the abbey. From this point, she could not fail to see anyone approaching the house. She sat there all day. I knew that she was watching for him, and I pitied her with all my heart, as the day wore itself out, and he did not come. We dined earlier than usual and made our tour of inspection through the bright rooms, while maids flitted to and fro laden with frilled muslin petticoats from the laundry, and a faint smell of singed hair pervaded the corridors. At 10 o'clock, the band were tuning their violins, and pretty girls and elegant-looking men were coming slowly down the broad oak staircase as the roll of fast-coming wheels sounded louder without, and stentorian voices announced the best people in the county. I have no need to dwell long upon the details of that evening's festival. It was very much like other balls, a night of splendor and enchantment for those whose hearts were light and happy, a wearisome kaleidoscope procession of form and color for those whose minds were weighed down by the burden of a hidden care. For me, the music had no melody, the dazzling scene no charm. Hour after hour went by, and yet Edward Crichton had not appeared amongst us. There had been innumerable inquiries about him, and Mrs. Crichton had apologized for his absence as best she might. poor soul. I well knew that his non-return was now a source of poignant anxiety to her, although she greeted all her guests with a gracious smile. Once, when she was sitting alone for a few minutes, I ventured to approach her at this moment, and never shall I forget the look which she turned towards me. "My son, Sarah," she said in a low voice, "something has happened to my son." I did my best to comfort her, but my attempt was a very poor one. Julia Tremaine had danced a little at the beginning of the evening, to keep up appearances, I believe, but after the first two or three dances, she withdrew to a seat amongst the matrons. The night waned, the dancers were revolving in the last waltz, when I happened to look towards the doorway at the end of the room. I was startled by seeing a man standing there, with his hat in his hand, with a pale, anxious-looking face, peering cautiously into the room. My first thought was of evil, but in the next moment the man had disappeared and I saw no more of him. I lingered by my cousin Fanny's side till the rooms were empty. There were only Mr. and Mrs. Crichton and myself in the long suite of rooms, where the wax lights were dying out, one by one. "I think the evening went off very well," Fanny said, looking rather anxiously at her husband, who was stretching himself and yawning with an air of intense relief. "Yes, the affair went off well enough. But Edward has committed a terrible breach of manners by not being here. Upon my word, the young men of the present day think of nothing but their own pleasures. I suppose that something especially attractive was going on at Wickerley today, and he couldn't tear himself away." "It is so unlike him to break his word," Mrs. Crichton answered. "You are not alarmed, George? You don't think that anything has happened? Any accident?" "What should happen? Ned is one of the best riders in the county. I don't think there's any fear of his coming to grief."
"He might be ill."
"Not he. He's a young Hercules. And if it were possible for him to be ill, which it is not, we should have had a message from Wickerley." The words were scarcely spoken when Truefold, the old butler, stood by his master's side with a solemn, anxious face.
"There is a person who wishes to see you, sir."
"Alone." Low as the words were, both Fanny and myself heard them. "Someone from Wickerley?" she exclaimed. "Let him come here."
But, madam, the person most particularly wished to see Master alone. Shall I show him into the library, sir?
The lights are not out there."
"Then it is someone from Wickerley," said my cousin, seizing my wrist with a hand that was icy cold.
"Didn't I tell you so, Sarah? Something has happened to my son. Let the person come here, Truefold. Here, I insist upon it."
The tone of command was quite strange in a mistress who was ever gentle to her servants.
"Let it be so, Truefold," said Mr. Crichton. "Whatever ill news has come to us, we will hear together."
He put his arm around his wife's waist. Both were pale as marble. Both stood in stony stillness, waiting for the blow that was to fall upon them. The stranger, the man I had seen in the doorway, came in. He was curate of Wickerley Church and chaplain to Sir Francis Wickerley. He told what he had to tell with all kindness, with all the usual forms of consolation which Christianity and an experience of sorrow could suggest. Vain words, wasted trouble. The blow must fall, and earthly consolation was unable to lighten it by a feather's weight. There had been a steeplechase at Wickerley, an amateur affair with gentlemen riders, and Edward Crichton had been persuaded to ride his favorite hunter, Pepperbox. His horse was winning easily when at the last fence, a double one with water beyond, Pepperbox balked his leap and went over head foremost, flinging his rider over a hedge into a field close beside the course, where there was a heavy stone roller. Upon this stone roller, Edward Crichton had fallen, his head receiving the full force of the concussion. He had died while they were carrying him from the course to Sir Francis's house. All was told. I looked round suddenly and saw Julia Tremaine standing a little way behind the speaker. She had heard all. She uttered no cry. She showed no signs of fainting, but stood calm and motionless, waiting for the end. I know not how that night ended, there seemed an awful calm upon us all. A carriage was got ready, and Mr. and Mrs. Crichton started for Wickerly to look upon their dead son. I went with Julia Tremaine to her room and sat with her while the winter morning dawned slowly upon us. A bitter dawning.
In the West Country, where I was born, there was a fair maid dwelling, made all the lads cry well a day. Her name was Barbara Allen.
I have little more to tell. Life goes on, though hearts are broken. Upon Crichton Abbey, there came a dreary time of desolation. The master of the house lived in his library, shut from the outer world, buried almost as completely as a hermit in his cell.
As she was walking o'er the fields, she heard the death bell knelling, and every stroke.
I have heard that Julia Tremaine was never known to smile after that day.
Said hard-hearted Barbara.
She is still unmarried and lives entirely at her father's country house. Proud and reserved in her conduct to her equals, but a very angel of mercy and compassion amongst the poor of the neighborhood. Yes, this haughty girl, who once declared herself unable to endure the hovels of the poor, is now a sister of charity in all but the robe. So does a great sorrow change the current of a woman's life. I have seen my cousin Fanny many times since that awful New Year's night, for I have always the same welcome at the Abbey. I have seen her calm and cheerful, doing her duty, smiling upon her daughter's children, the honored mistress of a great household. But I know that the mainspring of life is broken, that for her there hath passed a glory from the earth, and that upon all the pleasures and joys of this world she looks with the solemn calm of one for whom all things are dark, with the shadow of a great sorrow.